So I'm delighted to agree to talk about operational hidden variable models and contextuality. I'm going to start just by telling you my bias, where I stand on interpretational issues. So my personal opinion is that none of the standard interpretational programs that are on the table today are adequate. So we don't yet, in my opinion, have an understanding of what quantum theory is really saying. But I have some strong feelings about what the right direction for progress is. And perhaps the closest thing to what I think is right is a hidden variable model. So I believe in a kind of hidden variable approach, but one very different from Bohmian mechanics and the traditional sorts of hidden variable approaches. And by the end of the talk, I hope I'll get around to telling you what sort of hidden variable approach I think looks promising. Now, unfortunately, because there's only a limited amount of time, I can't tell you all the reasons why I think this sort of approach is promising. There's many reasons you could give. Instead, I'm going to focus on the problems with the approach. And that, for me, is important because it's the clues for how to succeed. You know, here's what's wrong, so this is where we need innovation, this is where we need new ideas. And so in my opinion, the biggest issue with hidden variable models is contextuality. So I'm going to be telling you what contextuality is, why you cannot have a non-contextual hidden variable model of quantum theory. And for me, this is one of the most important discoveries in the foundations of quantum mechanics. I think it's very significant. But I'm not particularly happy with the traditional notion, and so I'm going to try to generalize that. That's what most of the talk will be about. And to do that, I'm going to take an operational approach. So I'm also going to talk about operationalism. So here's the outline. I'm going to start off by just going briefly over the standard postulates and some problems with them and strategies for how to deal with those problems. And then I'm going to talk about the traditional notion of a non-contextual hidden variable model. And then I'm on to operationalism. So I'll talk about what it is to be operational in, about quantum theory and some interesting uses of operationalism in quantum foundations in general. And then we get to the meat, which is a proposal for an operational definition of non-contextuality, comparison with the traditional notion, some new no-go theorems, and finally I'll talk about what contextuality is actually useful for, and some experimental results on contextuality. And then finally, a bit of a change of topic, I'm going to end with this question of whether quantum states describe reality or a knowledge of reality, and the significance of that for the hidden variable program. All right, so let me start with textbook postulates for quantum theory. So this is, you know, one very simple synopsis of the sort of postulates you'll find in a textbook. So something like the rays of Hilbert space correspond one-to-one with the physical states of the system. Measurements are associated with Hermitian operators. Outcomes of measurements are indeterministic. And a particular eigenvalue occurs with probability corresponding to the expectation value of the projector associated with that eigenvalue for that quantum state. And then isolated systems evolve unitarily. And measurements associated with the Hermitian operator yielding an outcome k have the von Neumann update rule. So this is standard textbook sort of stuff. I don't want to go into it in great detail. This morning, Jeremy mentioned some of the problems with this standard approach. I just want to characterize it briefly as a conflict between what the collapse postulate tells you and what the unitary evolution postulate tells you. Essentially, on the one hand, it looks like the theory is indeterministic and discontinuous, and on the other, it looks deterministic and continuous. And the quantum measurement problem basically is this seeming conflict between the prediction of determinate properties for certain systems and indeterminate properties if you treat the measurement apparatus quantum mechanically. So that's just very briefly a characterization of, you know, why people are unhappy with the standard textbook approach. But I want to focus on something a bit different, not on those problems, but on a more general problem. Which is that if you look at those postulates, and you'll see that this notion of a physical state of a system comes up, But then you also have this notion of a measurement. And a lot of people are unhappy with that because the notion of measurement is not defined in terms of these more primitive concepts, such as physical states of systems. But isn't a measurement just another kind of physical system involving a physical interaction with the microscopic systems? So some people are motivated to try to eliminate measurement as a primitive concept from the postulates of quantum theory, and to be left with an interpretation wherein all the elements of the quantum formalism represent reality directly, or represent our knowledge of reality, and none of them refer to macroscopic concepts like measurements. But there's a different way you could go, which is instead to eliminate the notion of the physical states of systems as a primitive concept, and make the elements of the formalism represent just only macroscopic concepts like measurements. So ultimately, just lists of instructions what to do in the lab, experimental procedures. And that's all the theory is going to tell you about, what happens in the lab when you do this and that. So this is a very rough characterization of two sorts of approaches. On the one hand, you have a sort of a scientific realist approach where you're seeking a description of the theory where at the most primitive level, your description in terms of things like, you know, atoms moving through space, for example, or maybe strings or fields. Very abstract level. Whereas here, the operational strategy is that your explanations and your descriptions are going to bottom out at things like detectors going click. And so it's sort of more of an empiricist approach. You can find advocates of both sorts of approach. John Bell was famous for wanting to eliminate the term measurement from the statement of the theory. So here's a quote. "It would seem that the theory is exclusively concerned about results of measurement and has nothing to say about anything else. What exactly qualifies some physical systems to play the role of measurer?" So he wanted a criterion. Whereas if you look in the textbook of Asher Peres, he clearly takes the completely operational approach. "In a strict sense, quantum theory is a set of rules allowing the computation of probabilities for the outcomes of tests which follow specified preparations." And essentially, he argues that that's all it is, that you shouldn't seek more than that, that that's all a physical theory ought to do for you. Sorry. Yes?
In the end, even in the operational approach, you have some parts of formalism which you then identify as your detectors saying click, right?
Yes.
So there still is some realism to it in that sense. So then how do you define where your operational approach ends and where it even starts?
Well, I think there's a clear distinction between the sorts of statements that you take to be acceptable as an end of explanation, right? So if somebody says, "I think it's okay to end an explanation with, you know, the detector went click," or "that's how I describe events," then yes, that's a certain sort of realism, but it's very different from somebody who says, "No, I want to know, I want a description in terms of the detector built out of atoms, for instance, mm-hmm. and what those atoms are doing." So I'm going to go over both of these sorts of approach. I'm going to start with the realist strategy. And although there's, you know, many flavors of realism, I'm going to focus on a hidden variable approach to understanding quantum theory. So what is the traditional notion of a deterministic hidden variable model for quantum mechanics? Well, let me start by saying a few words about properties in classical mechanics. So in any classical theory, properties are essentially associated with regions of your state space. So take a simple example where you have a particle in one dimension. The state space is just phase space. And if I take a variable like the energy, for instance, and I can then define a property as, for instance, the energy being between values E1 and E2. That's the property that the system might have or it might fail to have. And what that corresponds to is essentially an elliptical region in the phase space. So I can say if the point representing the physical state of the particle lies in this region, then it has that property, and if it lies outside that region, it doesn't have that property. A more abstract kind of variable that you might consider would be one that just takes, say, three different values as opposed to a continuum in three different regions of your state space. So if I draw those regions here on the right. They look like this. And notice that you can write that observable now as a sum over these values, together with certain functions, which I'll call indicator functions, that are one in the specified region and zero elsewhere. So this function with these definitions is exactly the same as this one. And so in particular, I can interpret these things as just telling me whether the property associated with alpha having value A1 holds or not for the system. So if the physical state of the system lies in this region, then chi sub 1 of xp will be 1. So if I want to know what's the probability it lies in this region, I can just consult this, and the value will be either 1 or 0, depending on whether it's there. So clearly, it can only be 1. If it's 1 for chi 1 in this region, then it's 0 for chi 2 and chi 3. So the measurement, a measurement of this observable could only find one of those three outcomes. And now note that if you have a probability distribution over physical states, so if you don't know what the XP is ahead of time, so I've just drawn some probability distribution here, then you might only predict probabilities of these three outcomes occurring. So I would calculate the probability of getting outcome K in a measurement of this sort of variable by just integrating my mu, my distribution, with the indicator function of interest. So that just tells me integrate up the total probability of finding the particle in this region, given that you know the relative probabilities of being everywhere in the phase space. So that's just sort of a way of doing classical mechanics you don't see particularly often. But now note the analogy with quantum theory. Every Hermitian operator can be decomposed into its spectral resolution, a sum of eigenvalues multiplied by projectors. And the probability that if I measure that operator, I get a particular eigenvalue, AK, is just the expectation value of that projector. So ultimately, I don't really need these eigenvalues, because the probability of getting a particular outcome depends only on the projectors. It doesn't matter what those eigenvalues are for calculating the probabilities. Much like the observable I showed you earlier, the alpha, it didn't really matter what the values of A1, A2, and A3 are for calculating the probabilities of those three outcomes. Similarly here. And so the idea of a deterministic hidden variable model is that you should associate with each of these quantum states a probability distribution over some state space. It needn't be phase space. It could be something very exotic, but there's some state space, and we label points in it by lambda. We want to associate these guys with distributions. We want to associate Hermitian operators with functions over that space. But that's equivalent to saying we want to associate each of those projectors with an indicator function. And these indicator functions sum up to the uniform function over the whole space. So what you ultimately want to do is reproduce the quantum statistics by integrating out the probability of getting outcome k given that the state was lambda with the probability that the state was lambda. So it's a classical model of the quantum predictions. That's the idea. Okay, so here's just some cartoons of what that means. For a Ray and Hilbert space, you have a distribution. Every basis defines a way of carving up the state space into regions. And as an aside, in these sorts of models, if you want to reproduce unitary evolutions and projection postulate, you'll need some way of describing them in terms of changes of your distribution and collapses of your distribution into distributions that are entirely contained within one of these regions. But I won't need any of this for this talk. Okay, now here's where the troubles begin. It turns out that if you're in a three-dimensional Hilbert space, there are many measurements that will have a given projector in them. So if you take the projector onto the ray psi 1, for example, it appears in a measurement of this basis with psi 2 and psi 3, as well as a measurement of this basis with psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime. And the natural way of modeling that is just to say, well, there's an indicator function chi 1 associated with psi 1, and it's the same indicator function that's associated with psi 1 regardless of what it's measured together with, these guys or these guys. And so the only difference between this measurement and this one is how you carve up the rest of the space. outside of Chi 1. So maybe, you know, there's a difference in how you might carve it up. So this is the traditional notion of non-contextuality, that the way you represent something like Psi 1 does not depend on whether you measure it together with Psi 2, Psi 3, or Psi 2 prime, Psi 3 prime. Every projector is associated with the same indicator function, regardless of how it's measured. Questions about that? You're going to be hearing many more ways of characterizing non-contextuality.
It's a property of what?
It's a property of the hidden variable model of quantum theory. So you say, you propose to me a hidden variable model, and I say, well, is it the case that if I measure psi 1 together with these guys, you model that in the hidden variable theory in exactly the same way as if I measure psi with these other directions?
And you're saying that hidden variable models are either type can be experimentally adequate or only if they're only non-contextual?
Well, what we're going to find is that it's impossible to maintain non-contextuality. So if I give you particular kinds of experimental data, no non-contextual hidden variable model can reproduce that data. So this is a bit of an idiosyncratic way of characterizing things, which is going to be useful for me later on to connect up some things I'm going to be doing. Something that might be more familiar to you is the following characterization. So fix a particular lambda. Just ask about what do I predict for the outcome of experiments for a given physical state lambda. Well, you know that the indicator function associated with some direction psi will always be 0 or 1 for that lambda. And moreover, if I sum over the complete basis, I'm always going to get 1. So one of these guys has to be 1, and all the others have to be 0. And so I can just label these different directions by 1s and 0s. Only one of them can be 1, and the others are 0. And it could be any labeling I like, 0, 1, 0, etc. But the point is that if I have a different basis, then my assignment here has to agree with my assignment here on the ray that they share in common. So if I assign a 1 to this, I need to assign a 1 to psi 1 here as well. That's the standard way that people present the assumption of non-contextuality. So every triad of rays has to receive a single 1 and 2 zeros. Every pair, at most one of them, can receive a 1. And if I have two triads that have an element in common, if that element in common has to receive the same value regardless of which triad it's part of. OK, so with that, I can actually prove a contradiction. This was first shown by Bell in 1966 and by Koshin and Spector independently in 1967. So precisely what they proved is that a non-contextual hidden variable model of quantum theory for Hilbert spaces of dimensionality 3 or greater is impossible. Now, throughout the talk, I'm going to use the term contextuality in two ways, which might be a bit confusing. I'm going to use it in a way very similar to the way people use the term non-locality. So people, when they're careful, say there's no local hidden variable model of quantum theory. But sometimes, when they're not being so careful, they say quantum theory is non-local. And what they mean is, well, if you look for a hidden variable model that's local, you won't find one. And so just because that, you know, it's such a nice contraction, I'm often going to say things like quantum theory is contextual. And every time I say that, I mean, if you look for a hidden variable theory, a hidden variable model of quantum theory, you'll find that it has to be contextual. Right. So on to... Yes?
Again, why I'm making this distinction. So you say, what? When you look for a hidden variable theory or quantum theory, you will find that it has to be contextual?
Yes.
And so what's the difference than stating every hidden variable theory of quantum mechanics or quantum theory is contextual? Is there a fine distinction? But I suppose I'm missing it.
No, that's if I was being careful, I would say exactly that. Every hidden variable model of quantum theory must be contextual.
Yes.
And then perhaps what would be appropriate is to say that, you know, quantum theory itself has the property that every one of its hidden variable models is contextual. What do I call that property of quantum theory? You know, perhaps I could have called it crypto-contextuality. You know, every time I try to find an underpinning in terms of hidden variable theory, that underpinning is contextual. But instead of calling it crypto-contextuality, I'm just going to call it contextuality.
Oh, okay, so in fact, you're now looking for you know, deterministic models of quantum theory.
scale of quantum theory. So models which reproduce the traditional laws of quantum mechanics.
Yes, that's what a hidden variable model will do for me. Yeah. Yes.
I think you said it, but maybe you could make it more clear what contextualized for me to define the non-contextual.
Yes.
We'll assign 1, 2, 7, 1, and then whatever combination
right.
of database shows up. What is contextual then? Would this mean you assign in some
It just means the failure of non-contextuality. So there has to exist some pair of measurements, or some pair of rays which, when they appear in two different contexts, get different values. If that happens anywhere, then you say the hidden variable model is contextual.
But the thing that these psi 1 would actually, attain these values. So this is a real phenomenon. In one context, you would assign 1, and in another context, you would assign 0.
Yeah. I think things will become clearer as the talk goes on. Yeah. You'll get a better idea of what contextuality is. So don't despair. So here's a very simple, relatively simple proof of the impossibility of non-contextual hidden variable model. It's due to Adán Cabello. It's an 18-ray proof in a four-dimensional Hilbert space. So I've actually written the 18 rays twice. Each of them appears twice in the following list. And the way I've written them, every column corresponds to a basis of the four-dimensional space. So if you look, so these are just the components of each of the rays. If you look at these four vectors, you can easily verify that they're all orthogonal to one another. And if you look at these four vectors, you can check that they're all orthogonal to one another, and so on. So each one of these is the basis of four vectors. And so now from our rules, we know that one of them is going to have to receive the value 1, and the other three have to receive the value 0 by a hidden variable assignment. Right? So we're imagining that there really is some underlying reality which tells me if I did a measurement of this basis, what precisely the outcome would be. So I have to assign a 1 and 3 zeros here, a 1 and 3 zeros here, and so on. And I have to have this consistency property, that if I assign, for instance, 1 to the first guy here, then because that guy appears in this tetrad as well, he has to get 1 here. So that means that, overall, I'm going to have 9 ones assigned to all these elements, because every column has a single 1 in it. So there's 9 ones in total. But remember, each one of these 18 rays appears twice here. So however many of them I assign a 1 to, there's always an even number of 1s being assigned. So if it were possible to do this consistently, this coloring, then there would be both an odd number of 1s and an even number of 1s. That's a contradiction. Therefore, it's not possible to do this assignment. Questions about that?
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. So we should think of each of these columns as like my little triad, except it's got four legs. And so I have 9 different of these tetrads. Each one of them is a measurement I could do. And the hidden variable model is going to tell me, for a given lambda, which one of those outcomes is going to occur. So one of them gets the value 1. And the others get the value 0 for each one of the tetrads. Because the hidden variable model says, even if you're not doing the measurement, the hidden variable tells you which outcome would occur were you to do the measurement. So it specifies simultaneously for every one of these bases which outcome you're going to get. But also, the assumption of non-contextuality tells you if a given ray appears in two of these tetrads, it has to receive the same value in one as it does in the other. And so, for instance, this guy is the same in these two tetrads, so it has to be the same value. If I look for these two are the same. If I find any one of these, I'll find his partner somewhere else. I can't find them all. But anyways, you'll see that each one of these guys is paired up with another one in some other tetrad. So these are just the components. So I've got some default four-dimensional basis. And these are the components of all the vectors in that basis. So what would have to be true for me to have this non-contextual value assignment? Well, first of all, every basis gets a single 1 and 3 zeros. So there's a 1 in each of these, somewhere in each of these columns. And secondly, there has to be agreement whenever. So if I assign a 1 to this guy, he's 1 here. If I assign 0 here, he's 0 here. So I could just start doing this, right? So let's say we try. We put a 1 here, 0, 0, 0. And then we have to put a 1 here, which means that these three have to be 0. And then we get to the next one, and we have some freedom. You know, because these guys here, I don't think any of them appear in these. So now I have total freedom. I can specify the third one?
So you have to put a 0 for that?
Right, so I'd have to put a 0 here, exactly. But then, besides that, I have freedom, so I can now choose. One of these three has to be 1, and the other two has to be 0. And it would work out, and what you'd find is, as you tried to do this, you always ran into a problem. You would always get a contradiction. And my proof that this will always happen is that you necessarily have an odd number of 1s, by virtue of the fact that you have a single 1 for each one of these 9 columns. But by virtue of the fact that every one of these rays appears twice in this whole list, then you have to have an even number of 1s, because if you assign 1 to any one of them, its partner has to have a 1. And that's the contradiction. Yes?
Aren't you sort of, for this to have consequences for a realist interpretation, don't you have to say that each of these bases corresponds to an observable?
Yes.
What observables?
Well, Koshin and Specker actually were careful in their paper to say, here's a physical system where you could actually do the implementation. But,
it's obvious that any basis corresponds to an observable?
For finite dimensional Hilbert space, yes. We have ways of measuring any observable in a finite dimensional space. We have the technology. Yes?
So in computing the probabilities in that integral equation, we're assuming we're using a Kakowski measure for this.
Yeah, you need a measure on your state space of hidden variables.
And it doesn't matter what that is in that computing those probabilities. Are you assuming that's a Bagging integration, or is there any other way that I can conceive of a hidden variable model where I don't compute probabilities that way?
Well, you could have a finite number of hidden states, in which case it's just a sum.
It's not necessarily a continuous parameter space, right?
It doesn't really matter.
But I thought I just need a positive measure.
I don't think it's significant.
This is kept open as much as possible, actually, because you want to have as little assumptions as possible.
That's right. Right. Okay, so there's my contradiction. I had a second instance of a traditional proof, but I'm going to skip over it. It's just because you've seen a proof, that's enough. I recommend you to go read a paper by Rob Clifton where he shows a simpler 8-way proof, which I quite like. But I'm just going to skip it and mention what I think are problems with this traditional notion of non-contextuality. The first is that it applies only to deterministic hidden variable models. We imagine that if you told me the values of all the hidden variables, that would uniquely specify what outcome you'd get for every measurement. But you could imagine a hidden variable theory where that wasn't the case. And this notion of non-contextuality doesn't apply to it. Whereas, contrast that with the situation with Bell's theorem. People have defined locality in such a way that it applies both to deterministic and indeterministic hidden variable models. The second is that this definition was unique to quantum theory. And so, again, unlike locality, I can ask of any given theory, is it local or is it non-local, not just quantum mechanics. It'd be very nice if we could define contextuality in such a way that I could ask of any given theory, is it contextual or not, rather than just being able to talk about quantum theory. In particular, you want that to be the case if you're going to do experimental tests of contextuality in the same way that you would do experimental tests of locality. Because what an experimental test really does for you, it says, I'm going to get some data, and I want to know, am I in a world for which physical theory is local, or am I in a world for which physical theory is non-local? And you just look to the data to tell you where you are. Tests of Bell's theorem don't prove, they're really designed to prove non-locality. Even if quantum theory is wrong, nonetheless, the theory that governs the universe has to be non-local. So to do that for contextuality, you need this quantum independent notion, which currently we don't have, traditionally we don't have. So if we can do this definition, then we'll have a way of specifying whether any given theory is contextual and whether any given data requires contextuality to be exploited. And so the answer, can we do this, is yes. And the way to doing it is to be operational. So now I move on to a blurb about operationalism. And we're going to come back to contextuality. OK, so remember, I specified sort of two kind of extreme ways in which you could try to fix the standard textbook postulates of Bond theory. And one way is to eliminate the notion of properties and physical systems altogether. And so if you do that, what you're basically saying is that the only thing that, for instance, a vector in Hilbert space represents is a list of instructions of what to do in a lab. So strictly speaking, what it represents is a recipe, nothing more. It doesn't represent the physical state of a system in any realistic way. It represents a recipe book. It means go to the lab, open the aperture on your oven of silver atoms, and wait, or something like that. And so I represent that list of instructions as sort of a black box with a dial on it. So there's something going on inside here. Maybe it's all automated. You push the button that sets the automation in motion, and you have an aperture on the front end. Of course, this leads you to think that, oh, there must be a system coming out. But in an operational approach, you don't talk about that. You never say, oh, there's a system coming out of the box. You just say, no, I set this up with an aperture open, and I set up something beyond it with an aperture open as well. And we're not going to talk about whether something passes between them. So similarly, a Hermitian operator, or the spectral resolution of that Hermitian operator, which is sometimes called a projector-valued measure, represents just a measurement procedure. And unitary maps don't represent evolutions of physical states. They just represent things you could do in the lab between a preparation and a measurement. What distinguishes a measurement, I should say, is the fact that it yields some outcome at the end. A transformation just modifies the statistics of outcomes, so it modifies a preparation procedure. All you really have, according to this view, is, as an interpretation of quantum theory, is an algorithm for computing the probabilities of different outcome k's for the measurement, given a specification of what you did for the preparation, what sorts of transformations you did, and what sorts of measurements you did. And then here's the algorithm. Yes? I'm about to generalize the POVMs. So how many people here are familiar with POVMs? OK. And how many people here are familiar with completely positive maps? OK. So I thought I would just say a few words about that. We heard about mixed states this morning from Jeremy, but I'm going to briefly review that again. So the first indication that you need more than just these vectors in Hilbert space is the fact that, especially in an operational framework, is the fact that I can build a new device that isn't represented by any vector in Hilbert space. And the way I do it is I build a device so that inside the black box, a coin gets flipped. And if it comes out heads, I prepare psi. And if it comes up tails, I prepare chi. And then that's my preparation procedure. And then suppose I measure some observable later on. What's the probability of getting outcome k for that observable? Well, it's just the probability that I got heads times the probability of getting k given that it was psi, plus the probability that I got tails times the probability of k given chi. And if I rearrange this formula using the trace, I find that I just write it as trace rho pk, where rho is a convex sum of projectors onto psi and chi. And so the way I represent that new box is not with a vector in Hilbert space, but with something called the density operator. It has to be positive and have trace 1. So I'm going to talk about pure preparations as those associated with projectors onto vectors of the Hilbert space. And if your density operator is not a projector onto a vector, like this form, then it's called a mixed preparation. You can do something similar for measurements. So this will probably be less familiar. But suppose you do the same trick. You have a box, which is a measurement now, where you decide by a coin flip whether you're going to measure the projector value measure pk or the projector value measure qk. You work out the probabilities of getting outcome k, and you find that you have to plug in an ek in this formula, where ek is now a weighted sum of pk and qk. But whereas each of these guys was a projector, if I squared it, I got it back again, ek is not. If I square it, I get something different. But I know that if I sum over k here, I have to get 1. The probabilities have to sum to 1. So because that's true for all rho, the sum over the ek's is identity. So a positive operator value measure is just like a projector value measure. The elements are positive. They sum to identity. However, they don't have to be projectors. If they are projectors, we call it sharp. And if they're not, we call them unsharp. All right, so you can do the same thing for transformations. And I'm not going to go through that because I'm not really going to make use of it. But you know, you can have similar sorts of reasons for needing something more than unitary. And I should say that these are not the only reasons that we need POVMs and completely positive maps. We can also do things like take a system, couple it to another system, and then do a projective measurement on that system. And you find that the effective measurement that's done on the first can't be modeled by a projective value measure either. So in any case, the point is that if you ask operationally what are the most general ways of representing preparation procedures and measurement procedures, you find that the density operators and POVMs, not rays and PVMs. And similarly, the most general way of representing transformations is with these completely positive maps. And then if you're a strict operationist, you say the only content of the theory is to provide an algorithm for predicting the outcome k, given certain lists of instructions here. And that algorithm has the following form. Take rho, subject it to the CP map associated with the transformation, hit it with the POVM, and calculate. Right, so that's a crash course in generalized measurement theory.
Why is it necessary to have a POVM? I do understand the PVMs, but why should I have something more general?
Well, if I built this box, and I told you inside I'm flipping a coin and measuring one PVM or the other, and I said, all right, now please represent that in the formalism for me, you will find no Hermitian operator, no PVM, that can represent it adequately, in the sense of being able to calculate the probabilities of the different outcomes by a formula of the form trace rho pk, where the k labels the outcomes. So there's no set of projectors pk which the probabilities of all those outcomes are trace rho pk. You have to move to an operator that's not a projector.
But isn't generalizing the mixtures of projectors in some sense, right?
Yeah. In some sense.
No, more than that.
Well,
and you already admitted so, because you can have the large effects. And
that's
those
right.
are crucial sometimes, because those measurements are
That's right, so there can be POVMs that you can't measure as a convex combination of projector value measures, that you have to measure them by first coupling them to another system, and then doing a projector measurement on another system.
Is it a simple answer that you want to be describing measurements, the outcomes of which are not used?
Yeah, it's actually a good classical analogy is probably coming up shortly, which is that you could, for instance, have instead of indicator functions that are idempotent, which when you square them give you back the same indicator function, right? So I've drawn things like this. I could also have something which, say, went down to probability a half here. So this is probability 1, 0. So I could have something that looked like this. So if your hidden variable is here, then you have probability half of getting this outcome of the measurement, probably half of getting that outcome. And so these indicator functions now are sometimes people call them fuzzy indicator functions. They're no longer two values, 0 or 1, but they have arbitrary probabilities. And POVMs are like that.
Yeah, but I suppose you lost me a long time ago, so. Let me rephrase my question. So,
yep.
So if I really imagine you're often with a server down now, then somebody flips a coin, yes? Mm-hmm. Them, okay, so sometimes I get the same sign, sometimes I get the same clock.
Yep.
Okay, this is described by density pairs, yes?
Mm-hmm.
For this, I only need PVMs. Yes?
So what do you mean case? For this? PVMs are representation of a measurement.
Okay. So a density matrix I can represent a sum of PVMs, yes?
No, a PVM is a set of projectors. A density matrix can be written as a sum of
some
individual projectors onto states.
Okay.
A PVM is a whole set of projectors that sum up to identity.
All right.
They're two different uses of projectors.
Yeah, they're different sorts of things.
Yes, so, okay, so what I, but these projectors in a designator, okay, so what type are they? Why is there some about, so I suppose I'm missing something that's very elementary now. So, okay, so I write the density matrix as some linear combination of projection.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so then.
It's in fact not just any linear combination, at least it says it's a convex combination.
Course, yes.
Yep. Yes.
So
I'm talking with the state that there's a vision.
So if you say what is the most general way of representing a preparation procedure, it has to be one of these density operators.
Yeah.
A preparation procedure is the sort of thing that has a button and it's done. A measurement procedure is the sort of thing that has many outcomes associated with it. So the sorts of object you use to represent it is actually a set of operators labeled by that outcome.
Okay.
So traditionally, we represent it by a set of projectors. But the point of this slide was to show that for some sorts of measurement boxes that I can create, there is no set of projectors that could represent the probabilities of the different outcomes with the formula of the form trace rho pk. Because the probabilities are given by trace rho ek, and those eks are not themselves projectors. And so if I just want, I could keep saying, oh, well, the way to represent this box is now with two of these guys and with the probability P and Q, but I can sum all that up nicely, and the only thing that's important for the statistics of that measurement is what these EKs are.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yes, Oscar.
About this preparation transformation measurement,
yeah.
Are you assuming sort of time asymmetry by saying that, or first your preparation, then the transformation?
I think I am to the extent that there's a distinction between the preparation and the measurement. The measurement has some outcome which I don't know. So in a sense, I'm saying I know more about the preparation than I know about the measurement. I could imagine sort of a retrocausal approach where I say, look, I know that the measurement registered a certain outcome, and the preparation was one of a certain number of different possibilities, and then I would have a time symmetric formulation that way. But I think Sandy is going to be talking about time symmetric formulation. So I'm going to evade that question for now and try to move on. Too late. No. I don't think this the definitions of POVM, the generalized measurements is not going to be significant. All I really wanted to say was that if you're an operationalist, you realize that the things you associate with preparations and measurements are not states and Hermitian operators, but these more general objects. But I'm not going to actually need the particular form of those objects for anything I'm doing. I just wanted to flag that fact. I'm sorry? Which example?
The example of what?
Let me not go over it, and perhaps later we'll come back, because I'm going to be speaking more about this. So anyway, the idea is that if you're an operationist, you might prefer a set of postulates which associates density operators with preparations, POVMs with measurements, and transformations with complete positive maps. So this is how you would summarize quantum theory as an operationalist. And you know, these things, in my opinion, are very important for quantum foundations. And this is just an aside. I wanted to point them out. They may come up later. But let's move on and talk about. Actually, you know, because we've had a lot of questions and we're running late, I'm going to skip this section. I was just going to say a few things about how operationalism was useful. You can ask me about them. And I'm just going to move on to the use of operationalism that I want to make for coming up with a better definition of contextuality. So I want to now consider sort of an arbitrary theory characterized operationally. So now it's not necessarily the case that my preparations are represented by density operators. The only requirement you really have is that preparations are represented by some convex set of elements. And similarly, measurements have a more general representation than through POVMs. And I won't go into the details of that, but the point is that there are many theories that aren't quantum mechanics that can still be cast into this form of just specifying an algorithm for the probabilities of getting certain outcomes given a specification of what you did in the lab, preparation, transformation, measurement. And those algorithms differ from the Born rule of quantum theory. And so for any of those theories, you can ask, what would a hidden variable model of that theory look like? And so here's the idea. A hidden variable model is basically you're making the assumption that not only is this thing, you're assuming that when you do this preparation procedure, you actually do spit out a system from this device, and that system has well-defined properties, and it's the properties of that system that then lead the measurement device to have a particular outcome. That's the basic idea. But what's the most general thing you could assume? Well, it could be that by knowing, merely knowing this list of instructions of what to do in the lab, you know, where this knob was set, you don't find out everything there is to know about the properties of that system. Maybe you only find out that it's in some range of possibilities, that the physical state is, you know, here in the state space. But maybe you find out even less. Maybe you just find out that the relative probability of it being here in the state space and here in the state space is such and such. And so the most general thing is that you'll just have some probability distribution over the state space when you know that the preparation was p. So I write that as mu sub p of lambda, integrates to 1. You can ask the same question of measurements. What's the most general way you could represent a measurement? And so again, it could be that this measurement device just registers precisely what the physical state of the system you feed into it is. But it could also just register whether that state is in some large region or some other large region. Or, even more generally, the outcome you get of the measurement could depend probabilistically only on the value of the state. So if lambda is, for instance, here, then I definitely get outcome 1 with probability 1, 0 for the other two. But if the state's here, I get some non-zero probability of outcome 1 and some non-zero probability of outcome 2. And so these sorts of indicator functions are unlike the ones I showed you earlier when I was talking about traditional notion of non-contextuality, because they're not flat. And that's what's going on here. So certain measurements might respond to the system that's fed into them in a non-deterministic way. Right? So telling me everything there is to know about the system that's fed into this device still is not enough to predict with certainty what the outcome will be. Okay, so a hidden variable model of an arbitrary operational theory provides for every preparation procedure some distribution over the hidden variables. For every measurement procedure, it provides a set of indicator functions. And it has, if it's going to be adequate, it has to reproduce the statistical algorithm of the theory by this algorithm. So it says the probability of getting outcome k given measurement m, outcome k in measurement m given lambda, times the probability of lambda given p integrated over all lambda should give me the probability of k given p. Yes?
So what you're constructing here,
yeah,
is a perspective that still applies just as well with the old conservative definition. If I'm a guy who doesn't believe in all this stuff, I mean, what you're going to say still applies to, you know, indicator functions that have to be one, all that, right? You're not... Your theory doesn't depend on any of these radical notions you're introducing. Is that correct?
Actually, my definition of non-contextuality will depend on this difference. So yeah, the difference will come up, and it'll be important.
So you can't use this to analyze theories where the indicator functions are constrained to be one, and you have to have PVMs and that sort of business.
Well, I guess what I would say is this, that if you've explored those hidden variable models wherein these things are always flat, you haven't explored the most general hidden variable model. And if you're going to come up with a negative consensus on something like the property of non-contextuality, and you haven't explored the most general hidden variable model, then you know, maybe I'm not going to believe that I'm forced to assume contextuality. Maybe I'm going to try to expand this set of hidden variable models first and see if I can get non-contextuality by doing it. So that's why I want to consider the most general models. I'm giving non-contextuality the best chance possible to be true. Yes?
Is this counter argument to Robin's model apply also to your assumption of a linear transformation?
I'm not sure I'm following you.
are you going to have, your transformations are, I assume, linear in
yes.
the maps?
Yes.
So are you restricting your classical level models by restricting to linear maps?
Well, you can actually derive the constraint of linearity from just probabilistic constraints. Basically, by virtue of the fact that it has to be convex linear, it follows that it has to be linear, as, for instance, Leeson was shown in his excitation paper. So linearity is not an unreasonable constraint. I mean, it's passed by that.
When you've got these measurements like this,
yes?
Is this saying this is a bad measurement, or is it saying that lambda doesn't fully determine all the properties of the system?
Yeah, so here I want to, because we're being operationalists, a measurement is just something that generates an outcome. So, you know, were we realists, we might say a measurement is something that reveals something. From an operational perspective, I just want to call measurement anything that comes up with an outcome. So even a random number generator, in a sense, is a measurement. But the random number generators, what you'll find is that the way they're modeled is essentially, you know, that they'll all be sort of flat distributions with some non-one probability. So in a sense, if they're flat, then they don't depend on the state of the system at all. So if you want to know how good is it as a measurement in the realist sense of telling me something about the properties, then you're asking, you know, how sharp is it? So yes, unsharpness characterizes, in a hidden variable context, how good it is. Right, I'm going to move on because... yes?
So what's the motivation to introduce this hidden variable?
Well, it's, I think, a very reasonable one, which is that in the history of physics, the idea that there are physical systems with property has been extremely fruitful. So the notion that all physics is about is explaining, predicting the probabilities of certain things happening in the lab, I think, is a bit strange. So for instance, if somebody says, all physics is about is explaining when detectors go click, my natural response is, but isn't it also about explaining why there exist detectors at all? And why, you know, we are living here on a planet where we can build detectors, and why, you know, there's a solar system that came to be? You know, I think there's all sorts of questions in science which an operationalist type of attitude would suggest aren't good questions, and I think they are good questions. So that's my feeling for why you should move beyond operationalism. And a hidden variable approach is sort of the first thing you would try to do. Okay, so on to the definition of non-contextuality, quickly. So the proposed new definition is that a hidden variable model of an operational theory is non-contextual if whatever two experimental procedures are operationally equivalent, and I'll define what that means shortly, then they have equivalent representations in the hidden variable model. So let me proceed directly to tell you what that means. Suppose you've got a battery of preparation procedures in your lab. You've got a whole bunch of them. And you also have a battery of possible testing, a bunch of measurements. Now, you can define a notion, an equivalence relation among your preparation procedures in terms of the statistics they yield on measurement devices. So you say the two procedures are operationally equivalent if they give the same statistics for all measurement devices. So what I mean by that is if I take this preparation and I put it in front of this guy and I calculate its statistics, and then I put it in front of this guy and calculate its statistics, and so on. So I get a whole bunch of statistics for all these guys, and then I try it with this preparation device and I get the same statistics. So the same statistics on N5 that I got with this guy, the same statistics on N1 that I got with this guy, and so on. Then I lump these two guys into the same operational equivalence class. I say they might be different, I might follow different lists of instructions, but from the perspective of the probabilities of outcomes I'm going to get in any of these tests, they're totally indistinguishable. So if I put them in black boxes and I don't tell you which of the two I'm doing, which list of instructions I'm following, you can't figure it out because you'll do all these measurements and they won't be able to tell the two apart. So you can categorize the classify the whole set in terms of its equivalence classes. And then you can do the same thing for the measurements. You can say two measurements are operationally equivalent if they have the same statistics for all preparation procedures. And so you can lump them into equivalence classes as well. And then all that's important for statistics is which equivalence class you're in here and which equivalence class of measurement you're performing. So there's two features that a preparation procedure has. One is it's the equivalence class that you find it in. And the second feature, I'm going to call its context. So where you are in a given equivalence class. That difference between the two procedures, for instance, if you use a piece of Polaroid or a crystal to measure polarization, that may be two different things to do in the lab, but operationally, they look exactly the same. And so that difference between using Polaroid and using a prism is a difference of context for the measurement or the preparation. So that's technically what I'm going to mean by context. But this isn't a quantum concept. This is for any operational theory. And then the definition of preparation non-contextuality. So I'm going to have now two notions of non-contextuality. It won't just apply to measurements, but to preparations as well. And the notion is just that if two preparation procedures are operation equivalent, then they ought to be represented in exactly the same way in the hidden variable model. So this is a natural assumption. It basically says, what's the explanation? It is an appeal to the simplest possible explanation of why this and this can't be discriminated by any measurement device. The answer is, well, they're generating exactly the same distribution of hidden variables. That's why they can't be discriminated. You've looked at all your possible measurements, and you can't tell them apart. And the reason is that the only thing that's been mediated between the preparation device and the measurement device is this system. And the distribution over properties of that system is the same in the two cases. So of course you won't be able to tell the difference. Yes?
No.
Yes?
Maybe I'm just confused about is it realistic to assume that you can write an exhaustive list of all the possible preparations that you can ever have for a given system and assume that they're measurements?
You certainly couldn't list, write a list of everything you could possibly do in the lab. Like, today I did the experiment again, but I had cornflakes for breakfast. You know, like you could say that's a distinction. It could be important, but ultimately it turns out not to be. That's a context, what you had for breakfast, which turns out to be irrelevant. More realistically, I mean, you can organize the sets of things you can do in the lab into a convex set of possibilities. And I think you never really know whether you've done everything possible. So, I mean, you might overthrow your operational theory in the future by saying, I thought I had all preparations that could be done, but in fact, there were some more. Should we end up, we should break very soon, right? We started a little bit late. Should I?
Yes, you should take the 5 or 10.
Okay.
But you should also feel free to
feel a question. Okay, well, let me do a bit of guillotining for the moment, just so that I can't remember exactly how far I have to go before I come to a natural stopping point. Let me apply this definition to quantum theory, and then maybe we'll stop and take a couple of questions. So here's the cartoon that if two preparation procedures differ only in context, are in the same equivalence class, then they are associated with the same distribution over hidden variables. And if two measurements differ only by context, then they are represented by the same set of indicator functions. Let's apply this definition to quantum theory. So in quantum theory, we know that the operational equivalence classes are represented by density operators. If you tell me the statistics of all possible measurements for a given preparation procedure, then you specify the density operator for that preparation procedure. And there's nothing more to be specified. So if, for instance, I prepare, an equal mixture of left and right polarized light, or an equal mixture of, horizontal and vertical, or an equal mixture of left circular and right circular polarized light, those two mixtures have exactly the same density operator. And so they're represented, and so they're completely indistinguishable from the perspective of all measurements I might do in the future. And so that's operational equivalence, and similarly for the measurements. Here's some examples. Here's the one I just presented you with, essentially. This is a two-dimensional space, so this could be horizontal, vertical polarization. This could be left circular, right circular polarization. And because they sum up to the same density operator, the assumption of preparation non-contextuality is that those mixtures should be represented in exactly the same way in hidden variable theory. Another instance of a context, a way in which two preparation procedures might differ, is that they're associated with the same density operator, but it came about by tracing out two different entangled states on a larger system. So it turns out that there are many entangled states on AB, such that the reduced density operator on A is the same. So that could also be a difference in the list of instructions of what you do, you know, prepare psi or prepare chi, but then it has no effect ultimately on the statistics of outcomes of future measurements. So I could go on and provide more examples of context. The point is just that you now have a very general notion of what it is for a hidden variable model to be preparation non-contextual. These distributions can only depend on rho, nothing else. No other feature of the preparation device besides rho. And similarly for measurements, you can define different kinds of contexts. So one kind of context is the fine graining of your POVM. This could be a projective valued measure. But this is what we see earlier, what we saw in the traditional notion of non-contextuality. If I have a rank 2 projector, so I'm in a 3D space, identity minus psi 1 is a rank 2 projector, I can decompose it into a sum of psi 2 and psi 3, or a sum of psi 2 prime and psi 3 prime. And so I can actually think of measuring this projector in one of two different ways. You know, measure this and then coarse grain, or measure this and coarse grain. And that is not reflected in the statistics of this measurement device, whether you did one or the other. And so that's another notion of context. It's the traditional notion. And again, there are others which I won't go into. But the bottom line is, if you have a measurement non-contextual theory, then the only thing that matters about the measurement procedure is the POVM that's associated with it. That's all, because the POVMs label the equivalent classes. Right. So I'm going to stop there. That's the definition of non-contextuality. When we come back after the break, I'll give you a proof of preparation contextuality and go on from there. Thanks.